As I understand exactly what Andy meant. Millicent is enchanting. This is exactly as I would describe her. She was enchanting when I met her, and she is enchanting now. And if she died, and I had to speak at her funeral service, I would be just like Andy. If I had to describe how enchanting she was, at the same time knowing I would never be with her again, I would shake my fist at the sky, or at whoever had ruined everything. In Andy's case, it would be me, his friend. 37. The man on TV is overweight and unhealthy-looking, half-dead in his 50s. He has a soft, round gut, the beginning of jowls, and sprigs of gray hair around his head. I know the type. My clients are like him, or used to be. Josh is interviewing him in front of the Lancaster Hotel. This man is the first to say or even insinuate that Naomi was anything other than the girl next door everyone says she was.
I'm not saying she did anything wrong, he says. I just think if we're going to find her, we have to be honest about who she was.
He was a frequent guest at the Lancaster and came to town twice a month for work. He had spoken to Naomi several times, as well as to some of the other regulars. Let's just say she didn't always keep things businesslike with some of the guests.
Can you elaborate on that? Josh says.
I don't think I really need to do that. People are smart enough to figure it out on their own.
This is the first time anyone mentions Naomi's extracurricular activities. It is not the last. Other co-workers come forward, claiming to know the truth about Naomi. She slept with a number of men. Some were guests at the hotel. No one mentioned money, just sex. She was not a prostitute. Naomi was a 27-year-old woman who'd had sex with more than one hotel guest. The first of her lovers to come forward does not reveal his identity. On TV, he appears as a silhouette, and his voice is garbled.
Were you ever a guest at the Lancaster Hotel?
Yes, I was.
And did you know a front desk clerk named Naomi?
I did.
And did you have sex with her?
I am ashamed to say that I did.
He goes on to say that Naomi was the aggressor. She is the one who came after him. Another man comes forward, and another. More shadows, more garbles. All remain anonymous. None of the men who slept with Naomi will reveal themselves. It is not because they are married, because at least two are identified as single or divorced. They just do not want to admit that they were one of her men. Or her conquests. Someone on TV calls them that. At the club, the talk starts to change. People stop saying it is a travesty and a shame. Some even stop saying Owen is a monster. Instead, people start asking how Naomi could have prevented it, how she could have avoided being a victim. Kokona is one of them. The stories about Naomi confirm her belief that trouble comes to people who look for it, and in her mind, sex counts as trouble. On TV, they will not stop talking about Naomi's personal life. Josh is front and center on the story. Everyone who comes forward goes to him first. The more I watch, the more mesmerized I become. Naomi is one person, and then another, in the blink of an eye. The first time I have a chance to discuss it with Millicent is after we attend Jenna's latest appointment with her psychologist. We take her back to school, where she joins her friends to decorate the gym for an upcoming fundraiser. Millicent then takes me back to the club where my car is parked. She turns on the radio, and the news blasts out of it. The announcer says that yet another man, who remains unnamed like the others, has claimed he slept with Naomi while staying at the Lancaster. That makes seven.
Fantastic, Millicent says.
Fantastic?
As long as they're talking about her, or Owen, we don't have anything to worry about.
I want to bring up Jenna and how this might be affecting her. While I would like nothing more than for my daughter to be a virgin for the rest of her life, even I can admit that is not healthy. Millicent reaches over and squeezes my hand.
You were right to switch. Annabelle wouldn't have been the same.
This is true. It also makes me squeeze her hand back.
I go up to Jenna's room to say goodnight. She's lying on her bed reading an actual book because her laptop is downstairs. Her hair is a tiny bit longer now, and it is starting to look quite stylish, I think. She looks at me over the top of the book, asking, without asking, what I want. I sit down on the edge of her bed.
You want to talk, don't you?
She says. You're getting too smart for me. Jenna narrows her eyes.
Why are you flattering me?
See? Too smart. She sets down her book with a sigh. It makes me feel stupid, which is pretty common when I'm around my children. How are you? I say.
Fine.
Seriously. Talk to me. She shrugs.
I'm okay.
Do you like the doctor?
I guess.
You're not still scared of Owen, are you? Another shrug. For the past few weeks, our conversations have been like this. They used to be different. Jenna used to tell me about all her friends and teachers, what this one did or what that one said. She would babble on forever if I let her. I even knew about her first crush. He sat in front of her in English, which was part of why English had become her most difficult subject. Now she will not say anything, and it's because of the psychologist. I think she is tired of talking. I lean down and kiss her on the forehead. As I do, something flickers in the corner of my eye, between the bed and the nightstand, underneath the mattress. Something is sticking out. I recognize it from our kitchen. My daughter has taken another kitchen knife and hidden it under her mattress. I do not say anything. Instead, I say goodnight and leave, closing the door without a sound. As I walk down the hall, I pass by Rory's room and hear him on the phone. I'm about to go in and tell him to go to sleep, but then I hear him talking about Naomi. It's impossible to keep the news blocked out of the house. 38. I have kept a few things from Millicent, like the broken-down truck from so many years ago, and Trista. I did not tell her Trista had dated Owen Oliver Riley. Never mentioned that was why she left Andy, why she committed suicide. Petra. It would be silly now to mention Petra, the woman who suspected I was not deaf. No reason to bring her up. And Rory. I have not mentioned Rory's blackmail because that would lead back to Petra. Then there is Crystal. Millicent never wanted any help at the house. She did not trust that anyone would clean the way she wanted, nor did she want anyone raising her kids. The only time we did hire someone, it was to carpool the kids to and from school and to their various activities. That was a few years ago, when Millicent and I were both so busy at work, we just could not get to everything without some help. This was also right after Holly was killed, before the rest. Crystal was the one we hired to help drive the kids around. She was a nice young woman who was always on time and good with the kids. She worked for us until Millicent decided we didn't need her anymore. But before that, she kissed me. It was when Millicent was in Miami for a conference with a coworker named Cooper. I never liked him. For the 3 days Millicent was gone, Crystal was around more than usual. She picked the kids up from school and made dinner for them at the house. One afternoon, we found ourselves alone, and that's when it happened. At lunchtime, I went home to eat, and she was there, alone, because the kids were at school. She made us a couple of sandwiches, and we ate together while chatting about her family. Nothing exciting, nothing out of the ordinary, nothing that made me think she was flirting. After we finished eating, we bumped into each other as I went to the refrigerator and she headed for the sink. She did not pull away. Neither did I, to be honest. Maybe I wanted to see what she would do. She kissed me. I pulled away. At that point, I had never cheated on Millicent. I wasn't even thinking about it. I was thinking about Millicent in Miami with her male coworker. Before I had a chance to say anything to Crystal, she apologized and left the room. I don't think we were ever alone again. I considered telling Millicent right up to the moment I picked her up at the Orlando airport. I decided not to take the risk. I am thinking about this because I don't think I'm the only one not being totally truthful. I think Millicent has been lying to me. The idea came to me when Jenna got sick. I had just arrived home from work, and I was late. We were supposed to go to a party thrown by an association of mortgage brokers. Millicent was rushing around, trying to get ready. Rory was playing video games, and Jenna was throwing up in the bathroom. Millicent went to the party alone that night. I stayed home with Jenna. We have taken Jenna to the doctor about her stomach once before. Our family doctor says I worry too much. Kids get upset stomachs all the time, he says. But now she has them more often. Her stomach problems have gotten worse since Owen was brought back to life. This makes me think her fear of him is not getting better. It is making her physically sick. I pulled up a calendar on my phone and tried to figure out how often she was getting sick. One of the first times it happened was the night we were with Lindsay, when I'd left Millicent alone with her to go be with Jenna. Ever since Lindsay's body was found, I've wondered about that night, about what would have happened if Jenna had not been sick. Would we have gone ahead and killed Lindsay that night? Or would Millicent have told me she wanted to keep Lindsay alive? And when did she take care of her? When she was supposed to be at work? How did she sell all those houses and still keep Lindsay alive for a year? Too many questions I cannot answer. I have secrets. Why wouldn't she? My first idea is stupid. I thought I could follow Millicent to find out what she is doing, maybe where she is keeping Naomi. But as soon as I think of following Millicent, I realize why it is impossible. She knows my car too well. She knows my license plate. She would spot me in a second. Plus, I have to work. My job is flexible, not optional. But I don't have to follow her, because technology can do it for me. 5 minutes of research on the internet tells me this works exactly like in the movies. I buy a GPS tracker with a magnetic case, press the power button, and stick it on the bottom of her car. All I have to do is log into the app on my phone to see where her car is. The app also records the addresses where she stops, so I do not have to follow it in real time. The whole setup is unbelievably cheap, even with the fee for real-time information. Spying on someone has never been simpler. I make it sound easy, and technically it is, but the real cost is to my psyche and my marriage. Even after I buy the device, I don't put it on right away. It stays in the trunk of my car, burning a hole in the back of my mind. I do not want to blow up my marriage and my family, which is what will happen if Millicent finds out I am spying on her. I do not want to do it, but I want to know what she is doing. When I get home from work, Millicent is already home and her car is in the garage. It takes only a second to attach it. Later in the evening, it occurs to me that maybe there is a way for her to know there is a tracker on her car. All technology has counter technology, at least I assume it does. So I spend an hour on my phone looking up all the ways Millicent could find out what I've done. And I am right, she can find out. But first she would have to suspect she's being tracked. I look over at her. She's sitting with Rory at the dining room table, and they are making flashcards for his history class. He has never been a great student because, as his teachers say, he does not apply himself. Millicent agrees, and a few times a week she helps him do just that. No phones, no distractions, nothing but his homework and his mother. Not even I interrupt when Millicent is working with Rory. After a few minutes, she feels me staring at her. She glances up and winks at me. I wink back. Later that night, I remove the tracker from her car. The next morning, I put it back on. 39. When I watch someone in person, it feels intimate. They have no idea they are being watched, so they are not guarded or self-conscious. I get to know how they walk and move, their little tics and gestures. Sometimes I can even tell what they will do next. Using a tracker is much different, because I am not watching Millicent. I am watching a blue dot move around a map. The app tells me where she goes, the address, latitude and longitude,
I know how long she stays, how fast she drives, exactly how she parks. The app spits out charts and graphs that tell me how much time she spends driving, her average speed, and the average time at each location. I try to picture Millicent behind the wheel, dressed up for work, perhaps talking on the phone or listening to music. I wonder if she does something I don't know about. Maybe she sings when she is alone, or talks to herself. I've never seen her do either one, but she must do something. Everyone does when they are alone. On the first day, she drops the kids off at school and goes to the office. She works for a real estate agency, but does not spend much time sitting at a desk. After that, she drives to Lark Circle, to a residential address in Hidden Oaks. Over the next 8 or 9 hours, she goes to 11 houses, all of which are for sale. I check them all. She picks up the kids, stops at the store, drives home. The surprise is where she stopped to eat lunch. Instead of having a salad or a sandwich or even fast food, Millicent went to an ice cream parlor. For the rest of the afternoon, I wonder if she got a cone or a cup. Our dinner is roast turkey with chorizo and sweet potatoes. Rory glosses over the grade on his history quiz by telling an exciting story about a kid who was caught smoking and made a run for it before anyone could identify him. Jenna had heard the same story, but a friend of a friend said the guy was the vice principal's son, and that was why he ran.
False, Rory says. I heard it's Chet.
Jenna turns up her nose.
He's a jerk. Chet Allison? Millicent says. I sold the Allisons their house.
No, Chet Madigan.
You have 2 Chets at school? She says.
3,
Jenna says. There is a lull in the conversation. I ponder the abundance of Chets while sneaking a look at Millicent's plate. She has a thick slice of turkey, a scoop of chorizo, and a tiny sweet potato. For her, it is a normal-sized dinner. Dessert is fruit and ginger snap cookies. No ice cream. All of a sudden, I find myself fascinated by my wife's eating habits. I wonder if her lunch always determines what we eat for dinner, dessert, or both. I watch the blue dot again the next day. Millicent drops off the kids, but I pick them up, and during that time she is at a house in the Willow Park gated community. Today she goes to the office, but she does not stop for lunch. Again, she stays within a small radius, concentrated in the areas and subdivisions where she sells the most houses. In contrast, the police have widened their search. At night, after Millicent is asleep, I watch the news on my phone in the bathroom, because if I go into the garage, my son will think I am still cheating on his mother. Josh now starts his reports with the number of days that have passed since Naomi has disappeared. He calls it the count, and it is at 22. 22 days have passed since Friday the 13th, and Josh is still following the police around to abandoned buildings, sheds, and bunkers. An expert says this is probably futile, because Owen is watching the news, and therefore Naomi would not be kept in an empty building, shed, or bunker. Besides, a woman can be held anywhere, a single room, a storage container, a closet. The report is over in just a few minutes. It used to take up half the evening news. The story is starting to fade, because nothing new has happened, and Naomi is no longer the girl next door. She is tainted. The viewers have grown restless. And I have become mesmerized by the blue dot. In all my years of marriage, I have never wondered how much time it takes Millicent to show a house, or how long of a lunch she takes, or how many houses per day she sees. Now that I am tracking her, all of this has become intriguing. I check the app every chance I get, before and after tennis lessons, when I am in my car, in the clubhouse, in the locker room. There is no sign of Naomi. Millicent visits no unusual buildings or abandoned businesses, and the houses are all on the market. She goes to the store, to the school, and to the bank for a closing. After 4 days, I start to wonder if Naomi is already dead. As disturbing as it is, I think this may be the best-case scenario. If she is gone, never to be heard from or found, Owen may fade away with her. When he is gone from the news, it will be like he'd never come back. Trista will still be gone. Nothing can be done about that. But Jenna will stop being scared. She will stop thinking about Owen Oliver. Then, a year from now, Owen will be back on the news. The anniversary of the event will be marked with documentaries, specials, and dramatic recreations, but there will be nothing new to report. We will hear about Naomi and the men in shadows with the garbled voices. Once again, Owen will fade away. Naomi will go with him. Jenna will be a year older and talking about boys. Her hair will be long again, and she will not have a knife under her mattress. As the days go on, I start to think it is all happening. Naomi is no longer alive, and Millicent is not torturing her, not visiting her. The police still have nothing. Everything, all that we have done, will just fade away until everyone forgets. With a smile, I watch the blue dot. Millicent goes home in the afternoon, drops the kids off, and then heads back out. She stops at a coffee shop, and I know she is getting a vanilla latte, maybe with an extra shot, but it's hard to tell from just the dot on the map. I am so busy watching Millicent that I miss the breaking news. A woman claims Owen Oliver Riley attacked her. 40. I first hear about this woman when I'm at the Easy Go. A TV screen is mounted above the soda machine, visible to everyone in the store, including in the security mirrors. The breaking news banner is everywhere, but I pay no attention until Josh is on the screen. He says a woman has come forward to claim she was attacked by Owen Oliver Riley. She doesn't appear on TV, not even in shadows. For now, she is just a report filed with the police. The text appears on the screen, and a female reporter reads it. On Tuesday night, I became Owen Oliver Riley's latest victim, but by the grace of God, I got away from him. I am a hairdresser, and after work, we all went across the street for a drink. Later that night, I was at a bar out on Mercer Road, but I decided to leave because I had to work the next day. This was right around 11 p.m., and I remember because someone said it, and I thought I better get home soon, so I decided to leave. I was parked in the back lot, and it isn't even dark back there because of the lights, and the moon was real bright. Maybe it was a full moon, but I didn't check. It was light enough to walk by myself, so I did. Honestly, I didn't even think about Owen. He never crossed my mind. I was a couple feet from my car when I felt a tug. Felt like my bag got caught on something, the strap. It wasn't hard, didn't scare me. I just stopped and tugged, and it was definitely caught on something, so I turned around. He was just standing there, holding on to the strap of my bag. That's what it was caught on, Owen's hand. I knew it was him, even though he had a cap pulled down so low it covered half his face. I could still see his mouth, though, his smile. Everyone knows that smile. It's all over the news because he smiled in that old mugshot, and that's how I know it was definitely him, and that's why I let go of the bag and ran. Didn't get far before he tackled me. That's where I got all these scrapes, trying to get out from under him. But I couldn't, because he was just so strong, and every time I tried to move, his grip got tighter. I'm only alive because of my phone. My brother called, and I knew it was him because of the ring. I personalize all my rings because I like to know who's calling, right? My brother's ring sounds like an explosion, because that's kind of what he's like, a big explosion. His life always seems to be blowing up, and when it does, he calls me. But I can't complain anymore, because his life and that ring is why I'm still here. The exploding sound was so loud, it made Owen jump. His head whipped around, and I think he believed something had really blown up. I scrambled to get up and ran straight back to the bar, and he didn't follow me. I don't think he realized nothing blew up. Maybe he still thinks something did. That is the end of the statement, or at least the only part read on the news. The words disappear, and Josh is back, He is standing in the parking lot behind that bar on Mercer. I haven't been to that bar since I was about 20. Back then, they were known for not carding. Josh looks serious, sad. He is getting better because he no longer looks excited about something horrible. He calls the woman who got attacked Jane Doe.
Excuse me.
An older woman brushes past me. I'm still standing in the convenience store, right near the soda machine, staring up at the screen. The only other person watching is the guy at the register. It's not Jessica, the cashier I usually see. This guy has a bald head, which shines under the fluorescent lights. He looks at me and shakes his head, as if to say, "Isn't it terrible? Isn't it a shame?" I nod while buying my usual coffee and a bag of barbecue chips. This is what living with Millicent has always been like. Life goes along like it's supposed to. An occasional bump in the road, but otherwise a fairly smooth ride. And then suddenly the ground opens into a chasm wide enough to swallow everything. Sometimes what's inside is good, even great. Sometimes not. It happened when she told me Holly was alive. It happened when she bashed Robin in the head with a waffle iron. And again, when she resurrected Owen. These are the giant events, where the chasm becomes wider than the earth itself. Not all have been quite that large. Sometimes the chasm is just big enough to swallow me, like when she left with the kids and disappeared for 8 days after I came home drunk. And then there are the cracks. When the ground opens up, it causes cracks. Some are bigger than others, like Jenna having a knife under her mattress, or Trista killing herself. They are all different sizes, long, short, a variety of widths, but they originate from the same chasm. The first one cracked open on our wedding day. Millicent and I got married at her parents' house in a field surrounded by cilantro, rosemary, and oregano. She wore a gauzy white dress that hung to her ankles, and she had a homemade wreath on her head made of daffodils and lavender. I wore khakis rolled up to my ankles and a white button-up left untucked, and both of us were barefoot. It was perfect, right up until it wasn't. 8 people attended our wedding. The 3 guys I went overseas with were there, including Andy, not Trista. They were dating, but not married, and Andy wasn't ready to give her any ideas. Abby and Stan, Millicent's parents, were there, and so was a friend of Millicent's from high school. The last 2 were neighbors. The ceremony was just that, an act, a ritual. Neither Millicent or I were religious. We were going to get legally married the following Monday at the Woodview City Hall. In the meantime, we pretended to marry, with Millicent's father playing the minister's role. Stan looked so official in a plaid shirt buttoned to the neck and his thin gray hair smoothed down with gel. He stood in front of their herb fields with a book in his hands. Not the Bible, just a book. And he almost said the right words.
"Ladies and gentlemen, this young man wants to marry my daughter today, and I think he needs to prove himself."
Stan pretended to give me the evil eye.
"So make it good."
I had written and rewritten my vows 12 times, knowing I would have to say them out loud. The other people did not bother me at all. I was nervous about saying them to Millicent. I took a deep breath. "Millicent, I can't promise you the world. I can't promise I will buy you a big house or a fancy car or a giant diamond ring. I can't even promise we'll always have food on the table." She stared at me, unblinking. In the bright sun, her eyes looked like crystals. "I hope to give you all those things, but I have no idea if it will be possible. I do not know what will be in our future, but I do know we will be together. That's what I can promise you without hesitation, without any fear that I'd be lying. I will always be there for you, with you, next to you." I smiled a little because I saw a little tear in her eye. "And hopefully, we'll be able to eat." 8 people laughed. Millicent nodded.
"Well then," Stan said, turning to his daughter, "I guess it's your turn. Convince us this is the man for you."
Millicent raised her hand and pressed it against my cheek. She leaned in, put her lips right next to my ear, and whispered,
"Here we go."
41. At dinner, no one mentions the news or Jane Doe. She is here with us, but we do not acknowledge her. Instead, we talk about a celebrity who has gone to rehab. Again. We talk about a football game I did not see. We talk about what to watch on movie night. Rory wants to watch a college-aged comedy, and Jenna prefers a rom-com. The only current event we discuss is a mall shooting in the next state over.
"Sicko," Rory says.
Jenna points at him with her fork.
"You're the one who plays shooting games. The key word being game. But you like it."
"Shut up. You shut up. Enough,"
Millicent says. Silence. When dinner ends, they both go upstairs and retreat to their rooms. Millicent and I stare at each other. She points to me, mouthing the words,
"Was it you?"
She is asking if I am the one who attacked Jane Doe. I shake my head and point to the garage. After the dishes are done and the kids are asleep, we go out and sit in the car. Millicent brings our leftover Halloween candy, and we share a bottle of sparkling water. She's wearing a bright blue shirt with short sleeves. I think it is new because earlier in the day I watched her car stop at the mall.
"You had nothing to do with this woman?"
she says.
"Absolutely not. I wouldn't do something like that without telling you. At least, I don't think I would."
"I hope not."
"And I wouldn't do anything to make Jenna more afraid."
Millicent nods.
"I should have known."
"Maybe Jane Doe is lying," I say.
"Possibly. Or maybe some random guy attacked her and she just thinks it was Owen. We don't know what she saw."
"There's a third option," I say.
"Is there?"
I unwrap a piece of chocolate, break it in two, and give her half.
"What if he's really back?"
"Owen?"
"Sure.
What if it was him?"
"It wasn't."
"How can you be so sure?"
"Because it would be stupid. Why would he come back right when everyone is looking for him?"
"Good point." I am back in the beige office waiting for Jenna to finish with her psychologist. The doctor called after hearing about Jane Doe, saying he wanted an extra session. He is afraid this new attack will make Jenna regress. I am not sure she has progressed enough to regress, but I take her anyway. Millicent says she is unable to make it, so I sit in the waiting room and watch her blue dot. My wife is at a house on Danner Drive. It is listed for just under $500,000. Then she drives to a deli. Sometimes she goes out to lunch with clients, but I have never known her to take them to a deli. Millicent is just a few minutes from the doctor's office, but she does not come here. She goes to a deli, and she is still there when the office door opens and Jenna comes out. My daughter looks neither happy nor sad, which is about the same as when she went in. It is her turn to wait while I speak to the doctor. Dr. Beige. To me, he is always Dr. Beige. The name is neither fair nor accurate because only his office is beige. His personality is not. The doctor is a colorful, arrogant asshole. I have never met a doctor who is not.
"I'm glad I asked Jenna to come in," he says. "This new attack was quite a surprise."
Dr. Beige does not say Jenna was surprised, but it's what he means. This is how he gets around the doctor-patient confidentiality. "It certainly was a surprise," I say.
"The important thing is to let her know nothing has changed, that she's safe."
"She is safe."
"Of course."
We stare at each other.
"Have you noticed any changes in her behavior?" he says.
"Any kind of change?" "Actually, I wanted to ask you something. Jenna has been having some issues with her stomach. Nausea."
"And this started when?"
"Not that long ago. And it's been getting worse. Is it possible these are connected?"
"Oh, absolutely. Mental stress can absolutely manifest into physical issues. Has there been anything else?" I pretend to think about it and shake my head. No, I don't think so. I wonder if he can tell I'm lying. No one knows about the knife under the bed. Our talk is over when my phone vibrates. Millicent. Sorry I couldn't make it. How did it go? Her blue dot is just leaving the deli. Jenna is in the waiting room, doodling in a notebook while watching a daytime talk show. Her short hair makes her eyes look huge, and she's wearing a long t-shirt with her jeans and sneakers. I tell her we are going to grab a bite before picking up her brother. She smiles. Joe's deli is a 7-minute drive by my watch. When I pull into the parking lot, Millicent is long gone. The deli has seen better days, perhaps because of the location. Joe's is in the older part of town, which has been losing the battle against the newer and shinier side. Inside, it is bright enough to see the scratches on the counter and display case. The meats, cheeses, and pre-made salads look a little warped. We are the only ones in the deli, and it is silent until Jenna spins the display of potato chips, which creaks, perhaps from rust. A woman appears, as if she had been sitting down and suddenly stood up. She is plump and blonde and looks tired, but when she smiles, her whole face lights up.
Welcome to Joe's, she says. I'm Denise.
Nice to meet you, Denise, I say. We've never been here before. What's your specialty? She holds up a finger, telling me to wait, and disappears behind the counter. Her hand slips into one of the glass cases, and she grabs a platter of sliced meat. She sets it down in front of us.
Sugar spice turkey. A little heat, a little sweet. Not too much of either.
I look at Jenna.
Cool,
she says. We get two sandwiches, hers on 7-grain and mine on a Kaiser roll, both dressed with only lettuce and tomato.
You have to be able to taste the turkey, says the woman.
Joe's deli has an outdoor patio on the side, not visible from the front parking lot. A few tables are scattered within a walled-in area. It is clean and neat, but without any character. After a minute, it does not matter, because the turkey is that good. Even Jenna is eating.
Did you find this place online?
Jenna says. No, why?
Seems like something you'd do. Search for weird sandwich places.
It's not weird, it's good.
Mom would hate it, she says. It's not organic.
Don't tell her we came here.
You want me to lie?
I ignore that. What do you think about your doctor? Does he help? She shrugs.
I guess.
Are you still scared? Jenna points. Through the side door of the deli, she has a view of the TV above the glass counter. The blonde woman is sitting on a chair near the register, watching the news. The headline says that Jane Doe will hold a press conference tomorrow night. 42. Millicent and I are standing in the empty parking lot of the Ferndale Mall. The only sound comes from the highway behind us. It is Friday night, and Jenna is at a slumber party while Rory is spending the night with a friend playing video games. Jane Doe's press conference ended an hour ago. Millicent and I watched it at a popular restaurant and sports bar attached to the mall. The press conference was broadcast on every screen. The latest twist in our serial killer drama became a Friday night social, complete with chicken wings and beer. We watched it with another couple, the Reinharts, who believed every word Jane Doe said. Millicent is leaning against the car, arms folded over her chest, a stray hair blowing in the breeze. She always wears something appropriate for the occasion, even for this serious occasion at a sports bar. Her black jeans are paired with a t-shirt that reads Woodview Unity, a slogan that has popped up since Naomi's disappearance. Her hair is braided down her back, except for that one strand. She shakes her head.
I don't like her, she says. I don't like her story.
I think of Lindsay being held captive. Maybe Millicent hadn't liked her either. It doesn't matter, I say.
We don't know that.
So what?
We just need to know more, she says.
You aren't thinking.
I'm not thinking anything.
We stand in silence for a moment before Millicent turns and opens the door.
I watch her get into the passenger side of my car. She shuts the door and looks over at me. I have not moved. I can almost hear her sigh as she opens the door and steps back out. She is wearing shoes with rubber heels, and they are silent as she walks to me. Placing her palms against my chest, she looks up at me.
Hey,
she says.
Hey. You okay?
I shrug.
That means no,
she says. It is my turn to sigh, or huff, breathe hard, something. We've screwed up, you know, I say.
Have we?
I think so.
Tell me.
I don't know where to start. Everything is so jumbled, and I do not want to mention the wrong thing, like Petra, whom I have never mentioned, or Rory's blackmail. She knows about Jenna, but not everything. Trista's suicide, the tracker on the car, Joe's deli. There is so much Millicent does not know, and still, I feel like there is so much more to discover. The Owen thing, I finally say. It's out of control.
I don't think so. What about Jenna? I should have seen that coming.
Her response surprises me. It is not often she makes a mistake, let alone admits it. Because of this, I decide not to tell her what Dr. Beige said. It doesn't seem like a good time to tell her this whole thing is making Jenna physically sick. We are hit by headlights as a car comes around the corner of the mall. As it comes closer, I see it is not a car at all. The security vehicles for the mall are golf carts, and this one is driven by a middle-aged woman. She stops and asks us if everything is all right. Millicent waves to her.
Everything's fine. My husband and I are just discussing our son's grades. Oh, I understand that. Got 3 of my own. Then you get it.
The guard nods. She and my wife smile at each other as some motherly understanding passes between them.
Best move along, though. The mall is closed.
Thanks. We'll get going,
Millicent says. The guard waits as we get into the car and drive away. When we stop at a red light, Millicent puts her hand on my arm.
I was thinking we should enroll Jenna in a self-defense class. I think it would help her confidence.
That's a good idea. And it is.
I'll look into it tomorrow.
Millicent's stop at Joe's Deli is not a one-time event. She goes again the next day at lunchtime, and she stays for 40 minutes before going to show another house. None of her other stops are out of the ordinary. She even looks at 2 different martial arts schools for Jenna and tells me about them after dinner when we are alone in the bedroom.
One of the schools teaches competitive taekwondo. They have meets and teams and compete for ribbons. But there's another one downtown for Krav Maga. It's a little more expensive, but more geared toward self-defense.
She could try out both. Let her pick which one she likes. Millicent comes over and kisses me on the nose.
You are so smart.
I roll my eyes. She giggles. She does not mention the sandwich shop or the plump blonde woman with the big smile. I try to think of a way to bring up what she ate for lunch without asking, "What did you have for lunch today?" out of the blue. But I'm not as smart as Millicent says, because when I start rambling about how good my own lunch was, she does not reciprocate. She just nods and smiles while getting ready for bed, acting interested in my long monologue about a fictitious lunch. We go to bed without discussing Joe's Deli. In the middle of the night, I get up and go down to the library. We call it the library because we filled it with shelves and books and a big mahogany desk, but the only thing we use it for is private phone calls. I have also started using it to surf the internet in private. Joe's Deli opened 22 years ago. The business has had 2 owners, not related to one another, and the deli has always been in the same building, rented, not owned. No trouble other than a slip-and-fall lawsuit filed by a man who claimed the floor was wet. It was settled out of court. No other crime, lawsuits, or serious health code violations. Joe's Deli is exactly as it appears, a run-of-the-mill deli. The fact that it is so normal makes the whole thing suspicious. Millicent had no reason to go there once, let alone twice. The satellite maps of the area show a freestanding building on what used to be a much busier road. A
Across the street, there is a small used car lot. Next to that, a plumbing supply store, then a watch repair shop. If she had stopped there only once, it could have been a fluke. An out-of-the-way place that someone had told her about and she decided to try, but quickly realized it wasn't her kind of place. I would even be willing to believe she stopped because she was thirsty and Joe's was the only place around, even though it was miles from her usual area. I would believe just about any one-off reason for her to stop at Joe's, except that 2 days later, she went back. She has another reason for going to Joe's. At first, I think it's Naomi. Perhaps she was being held in that area, but Millicent didn't stop anywhere else. There are no empty buildings or shuttered businesses in the area, no place she could walk to from the parking lot at Joe's. It doesn't make any sense. Not unless she has developed a taste for unhealthy, non-organic sandwiches. And I know that hasn't happened. 43. After Holly, it never occurred to me there would be another. Not until Robin showed up at our door threatening to ruin everything unless I paid her. After Robin, it never occurred to me there would be another. Not until I wanted to do it again. The idea had been floating around for a while. First at the New Year's Eve party when Millicent and I talked about the other women. The conversation continued over the next few months to the point that we looked up women online. The activity became our aphrodisiac. We talked about how we would kill them, and how we would get away with it, and those nights always ended with amazing sex, wild sex, in every place we could, provided the kids weren't around. If they were in the house, we struggled to be quiet. It was almost as if we were climbing a ladder. We joked about it, talked about it, picked out women, and planned it. Every time we escalated to one rung, we stepped up to another. Then someone suggested we do it for real. It was me. I said it while we were in the kitchen. It was late morning, and we were naked on the cold tile. We had just found Lindsay online. Both of us agreed she was perfect. We should just do it, I said. Millicent giggled. I think we did just do it. Not that. Well, yes, that, but it's not what I meant. You meant we should kill Lindsay. I paused. Yes. Yes, I did. Millicent looked at me with a mixture of surprise and something else. At the time, I wasn't sure. Now I think it was interest, or intrigue, but not revulsion. Did I marry a psychopath? She said. I laughed. So did she. The decision was made. Millicent has never reminded me about that night, never said it was my idea, never said it was my fault. But I know it is. If it weren't for me, there would be no Lindsay, no Naomi, and Owen would not be back. Our daughter would still have long, shiny hair, and she wouldn't have a knife under her mattress. Or maybe it had been Millicent. Maybe she led me there all along. I don't know anymore. But a few days later, I am once again reminded of that decision and the unintended consequences of it. The martial arts studios let Jenna sit in on a beginner's class to see if she liked it. First, we went to Taekwondo. Half an hour later, Jenna shook her head at me and we left. She does not want to be in competitions, nor does she want to win ribbons and trophies. Jenna wants to fight off Owen. The following afternoon, we went to Krav Maga. Unlike Taekwondo, the Krav Maga school does not require uniforms or belts, which Jenna liked a lot better than the white gi everyone at Taekwondo had to wear. Jenna preferred to wear her sweatpants and t-shirt. It never occurred to me that she would hurt the boy who was trying to teach her something, much less try to knock him out. The whole thing happened so fast no one saw it, not even me, and I had been watching Jenna from a row of chairs designated for parents. One minute they were both standing up and the boy was showing Jenna how to form a proper punch. The next minute he fell to the floor and screamed in pain. A few drops of blood hit the mat and everyone lost their minds. What the, how did, is that a rock? A mom in a turquoise jumper pointed to Jenna. She did it,
She hit him with a rock!
Pandemonium followed, along with a lot more screaming and big accusations. It took a few hours to sort out, in part because the boy's mother arrived and started yelling about why no one had called an ambulance. That made someone call an ambulance, and the police. Two uniformed officers showed up and asked what happened. The boy's mother pointed at Jenna and said, "She hit my son!" Understandably, the officers were confused, because we were in a Krav Maga studio where people get hit on a regular basis. They also thought it was a little funny that the boy was hit by a girl. The man who owned the studio did not think it was funny at all. In the end, the boy was fine. The blood had come from a small cut on his lip and really was just a few drops. No one went to the hospital and no one got arrested, but Jenna and I were disinvited from the Krav Maga studio. Throughout the course of the afternoon, the boy's mother vowed more than once that she would sue. And on top of everything else, I was forced to cancel several tennis lessons and pissed off at least one client. Once we were in the car, alone, I asked, "Why?" Jenna stared out the window. "You must have had a reason," I said. She shrugged.
"I don't know. Maybe to see if I could."
Could hit that kid with a rock?
Could knock him out.
I do not point out the obvious. She did not knock him out. All she did was split his lip.
"Are you going to tell Mom?"
Jenna said. "Yes."
"Really?"
Actually, I had no idea. At that moment, I could not even look at Jenna. She has never reminded me of Millicent. When Rory was born, he already had little tufts of red hair. Jenna was born bald. When her hair finally started growing in, it was the same color as mine, dark brown, without a hint of red. Her eyes were the same as mine, too. I was so disappointed. It was not personal. It was not anything Jenna had done or hadn't done. I just wanted a little red-haired girl to match my boy and my wife with the flame-colored hair. This was the picture in my mind, the image I had when I thought about my family. The real Jenna did not fit, because she looked like my mother instead of her own. The first time she ever reminded me of Millicent was when she hit that boy with a rock. She looked just like Millicent did when she hit Robin in our kitchen. What I found sexy in my wife was horrifying in my daughter. 44. It is late at night. Millicent and I are in her office. She works for Abbott Realty, a small pond of a business where she has been the big fish for years. The office is in a strip mall sandwiched between a gym and a Chinese restaurant. Inside, it is empty and private because no one is looking for real estate at this hour. The downside is the glass front, which means anyone can see inside. The open layout of the desks provides no cover, so we leave the lights out and sit in the back. If the circumstances were different, it might be romantic. Millicent knows about Jenna. A friend told her before I could, sending her into a rage. She called and yelled loud enough to make my eardrum vibrate, because she said I should have called her when we were still at the studio. She is right. Now Jenna is safe at home, asleep in her bed, and not throwing rocks. Not throwing up. Not cutting off what's left of her hair. Millicent is calm. She even brought dessert, a single chocolate eclair. She cuts it in two, and the halves are perfectly even. I take a bite of mine, and she takes a bite of hers, and I wipe chocolate off her top lip.
"She's not okay," Millicent says.
"No."
"We need to talk to her doctor. I can call."
"Is she like Holly?" I say. Millicent sets down her eclair as if it's about to explode.
"Like Holly?
Maybe it's the same thing. The same illness."
"No."
"But no. Holly started torturing bugs when she was two. Jenna is nothing like her." By that comparison, she is right. Jenna screams whenever she sees a bug. She can't even kill a spider, let alone torture one. "Then it's our fault," I say. "We have to get rid of Owen."
We've been trying to.
I think the hunt for Naomi should end, I say. We should let her be found.
How will that help so we can get rid of Owen for good?
When Millicent starts to point out the obvious, I hold up my hand. I know. Hard to get rid of someone that isn't even around, right?
That would be one way to put it.
He was a great idea, I'm not denying it. But we've caused so many problems.
So many?
Jenna, the people in this town, women are really afraid. I am careful to omit what she doesn't know, like Trista. Millicent nods.
I never meant to hurt Jenna. I know you didn't.
I lean forward in my chair, closer to Millicent, so that she won't miss what I'm saying.
It would be difficult, if not impossible, to fake his death without a body.
Really, the only way is if he drowns in the ocean or a lake and is never found. But there would be doubt. And to make it halfway plausible, we would need someone credible to tell the story.
Like Naomi,
Millicent says. And what are the chances of letting Naomi do that?
In the negative.
Then maybe Owen doesn't die. Maybe he just leaves. I pause here, waiting for a reaction. When she doesn't say anything, I keep talking. Owen has such a big ego. He wrote to a reporter so everyone knew he was back and knew exactly when he would grab his next victim. So why wouldn't he tell everyone he's going to leave? He's the type that would brag about what he did. He would say, I told you exactly what I was going to do and when I was going to do it, and you still couldn't catch me. Now you'll never find me. Millicent nods a little, like she's thinking about it. I know it's not ideal, I say, but if Owen's gone, everyone will stop talking about him, and maybe Jenna won't be scared anymore.
The timing has to be right, she says. They need to find Naomi before you send another letter.
Oh, absolutely.
I'll take care of that first.
Maybe we should do it together. She looks at me, her head tilted to one side. For a moment, I think she's going to smile, but she doesn't. This is too serious now. We have moved beyond using this as foreplay.
I can take care of Naomi,
she says.
You concentrate on the letter. You have to make everyone believe Owen has left.
I want to argue and go with my idea, but instead I nod. Her idea makes sense. She sighs a little.
I hope this works.
Me too. I reach over and slip my hand into hers. We sit like this until she picks up what's left of my éclair and takes a bite. I take hers and do the same. A tiny smile appears on her face. I squeeze her hand. We'll be fine, I say. Millicent has said this before. She said it when we were young and broke with one baby and another on the way. She said it when we bought our first house and then the second, bigger one. She also said it after Holly, when her body was lying in our family room, her head smashed by the tennis racket. While I stood over Holly, coming to grips with what I had just done, Millicent went straight to work. Do we still have that tarp in the garage? She said. It took me a second to process. Tarp? From when we had that leak? I think so.
Get it.
I paused, thinking we should call the police, because that's what you do when you kill someone out of self-defense. You call the police and explain what happened, because you did nothing wrong. Millicent read my mind.
You think the police will believe Holly was a threat to you? She said.
Me, the athlete. Me, with the broken tennis racket. Holly, with no weapon at all. I did not argue. I went out to the garage and dug through the shelves and plastic containers until I found the rolled-up blue tarp. When I returned to the living room, Holly's body had been readjusted, her legs were straightened, and her arms flat at her side. We spread the tarp out on the floor, and together Millicent and I wrapped the body like a mummy.
Let's move her into the garage, Millicent said.
It was almost like she didn't have to think about it. I did what she said, and Holly ended up in the trunk of my car. I took her out to the woods and buried her while Millicent cleaned up the blood.
By the time the kids got home from school, every sign of holly had been scrubbed out. We did the same thing with Robin, only she didn't get buried in the ground. Her body and her little red car ended up at the bottom of a lake. Millicent is right. We have always been fine. Now it's my turn to make sure of it. Both halves of the eclair are gone, and Millicent brushes the crumbs into a wastebasket. We stand up to go, walking back through the dark office and out to the car. It's late. Even the Chinese restaurant is closed, but the gym is available 24 hours. It stands out like a single halogen star in a dark sky. Before starting the car, I turn to Millicent. She is checking her phone. I reach over and put my hand against her cheek, the same way she has touched me so many times. It makes her look up in surprise. "So do we have a plan?" I say. She smiles all the way up to her eyes. "Definitely." 45. The noise is gone. For the first time, as improbable as it seems, clarity comes all at once. Until I saw Jenna hit that boy, I never realized Millicent and I have been doing more than we realized. We have been destroying our own family. Owen's final letter is the easiest one to write. I have a goal now, to get rid of Owen, and it feels like I know how to achieve it. Though I will send it to Josh, as I always do, the letter is really addressed to the public. I tell them they are stupid. I gave this to you. I tried to help you catch me by letting you know when, the exact day, I would take my next victim. I even gave you 2 weeks to prepare, to plan. Yet you failed. You didn't stop me, couldn't catch me, and because of you, Naomi is dead. Let there be no mistake. Her death isn't my fault. It's yours. She knew it. Naomi had seen the same reports, had read my earlier letter, yet she was still out alone on that Friday the 13th. Naomi knew she had been stupid. She had faith, though. Faith that you were looking for her. Faith that you would find her. She was half right. If I had the time, I would tell you everything I did to her. Every mark, every cut, every bruise. But that would be redundant. You already have her body. Really, there isn't anything else to say. We played a game, and you lost. Naomi lost. Everyone lost but me. And now I'm done. I came back and accomplished my goal. I have nothing left to prove. Not to you, not to myself. Goodbye. Finally. Once the final version is done, I tell Millicent. She has come to the club to pick up Rory, who played golf after school and is done before I am. Millicent stops by the tennis court where I am waiting for my next client. Her flesh-colored heels thump against the cement as she walks toward me with a smile. Days have passed since our late-night conversation. Now that Jane Doe has gone public, she has been giving interviews to anyone who asks. She was impossible to avoid until Jane Doe number 2 arrived last night. Instead of having a press conference, she live-streamed her story on the internet, and the local news rebroadcast it. The woman is younger than the others, maybe still in college, and she has jet black hair, pale skin, and lips that look painted with blood. Jane number 2 is almost the opposite of Owen's typical victims, but she told almost the same story as Jane number 1. Only the parking lot was different, along with a few dramatic tweaks. This Jane claimed Owen hit her in the face, and she showed off a purplish bruise on her cheek. As soon as the live stream ended, my old friend Josh appeared on TV. Of late, Josh has been very serious, but last night he sounded almost sarcastic. He did not come right out and say he thought Jane Doe number 2 was a liar, but he may as well have. I cannot imagine anyone believed her. I know I didn't. The problem is that women like her are keeping Owen as the lead story on the news. I do not have to remind Millicent of this as she walks onto the tennis court. "I'm ready whenever you are," I say.
Her dark sunglasses hide her eyes, both from the sun and from me, but she nods.
Hello to you, too.
Sorry. I lean over and kiss her on the cheek. She smells like citrus.
Hello. Hello. The letter is ready?
Do you want to read it? I want her to say yes. I want to watch her read it. But she shakes her head.
I don't need to. I trust you.
Oh, I know. Just asking. She smiles and kisses me on the cheek.
See you at home. Dinner at 6.
Always. I watch her walk away. She does not go to Joe's Deli today. Today is all work, either at the office or open houses. I still watch the tracker, still check where she is going, but it is not because I want to know about Naomi. I already do. If she is not already dead, she will be soon. I watch the tracker because I like to watch Millicent. Another day goes by, then another, and Josh is back to counting down how many days have passed since Naomi went missing. I watch him on my phone all the time, waiting for the breaking news announcement about her body. Even when I wake up in the middle of the night, I feel an urge to see if anything is happening. On the internet, news can break at any time. Normally, this is not a problem, but now that I am waiting for news to break, it is infuriating and inconvenient. I go downstairs and out to the backyard where I check my phone. The news is the same as when I went to bed. Nothing is breaking. Nothing is happening. It is like a boring rerun. But I'm not tired. At 2 a.m, the air is still, and so is our neighborhood. No one in Hidden Oaks throws late-night parties or even plays loud music. I don't even see a light on in any of our almost mansions. I wish I could say this was our dream home, that we took one look at it and knew it was the place we wanted to be, the place we had worked so hard to get. It isn't true. Our dream home is a bit deeper into Hidden Oaks, where the houses become real mansions. The inner circle is for hedge funders and surgeons. We live in the middle circle, but only because of a nasty divorce, which led to frozen assets, followed by a bank foreclosure. Because Millicent had sent that bank a lot of mortgage business, we were able to buy a house we should not have been able to afford. This is why we live in the middle of Hidden Oaks. We should be in the outer circle, but once again, I found my way into the middle. The sound of rustling bushes makes me jump. There's no wind tonight. The noise comes from the side of the house. If we had a dog, I would assume it made the noise, but we don't. We don't even have deer in this area. The rustle comes again, followed by a creaking sound. With my phone in hand, I get up to investigate. Our back porch is about half the length of the house, from the kitchen to the corner. In the dark, I walk over to the far railing. The path along the side of the house is partially lit by a street lamp, and it's empty. No animals, no burglars, no serial killers. A soft scraping noise comes from above. I look up just in time to see Rory sneaking back into the house. I had no idea he'd snuck out. 46. Partying, drugs, girls, or just because. These are the reasons Rory sneaks out of the house. They are the same for all teenage boys. I first snuck out to smoke weed. Next, I snuck out because it worked the first time. Eventually, it was because of Lily. My parents never knew. Or, more likely, they never cared. And yet, even when Rory saw me sneaking out, it still did not occur to me that he was doing the same thing. This is how oblivious I have been. Instead of confronting Rory when I see him, I wait until the next day. This gives me a chance to see if there is anything I missed, anything I should know before having this conversation with him. His room is messy, as always, except for his desk. It is almost obsessive-compulsive, but not officially, because he isn't particular about anything else. He doesn't care if his clothes are piled up or his books are all over the floor, but his desk is always orderly, maybe because he never uses it. Normally, I would never search through his room. I have never done it before. But then I've never seen him sneak out before. My son has secrets, and in my book, that warrants a search. Rory is at school. He has his phone with him, and he is not allowed to keep a computer in his room, so my search takes place in the analog world. The nightstand comes first, then his desk, the dresser, and the closet. I even look under the bed, under the dresser, and in the back of his sock drawer. It is the most disappointing search. No porn, because he looks at it online. No notes from girls, because they text. No pictures, because they are on his phone. No drugs or alcohol, because if he is using them, he isn't stupid enough to hide them in his room. That's something, I suppose. My son is not an idiot. I do not tell Millicent, because she has enough to do. She does not know. If she did, Rory would already be grounded for life. But she doesn't know, because she would never hear him. Millicent sleeps like a rock. I am not even sure the fire alarm would wake her up. It's almost lunchtime when I'm done with that pointless search, so I head to the school. The office administrator sends a text to his teacher, who sends him to the office. Even though Rory and Jenna attend a private school, uniforms aren't required. They do have a dress code, so every day Rory wears khakis and a button-up. Today the shirt is white. His backpack hangs on one shoulder, and his red hair needs to be trimmed. As soon as he sees me, he brushes the bangs off his forehead.
"Everything okay?"
he says. "Everything's great. Just thought we might spend the afternoon together." His eyebrows lift, but he does not argue. For now, being with me is still better than his afternoon classes. Lunch is at Rory's favorite restaurant, where he orders the steak Millicent never cooks for him. He does not question it until the waitress brings a soda, which we do not keep in the house. He knows something is up, so it is no surprise when he says,
"What's up, Dad?"
But it is a shock when he follows it up with,
"Are you and Mom getting divorced?"
Divorced?
Why would you even ask such a thing?
He shrugs.
"Because this is the kind of thing you do when you have to say something like that."
"Is that right?"
"Yeah."
He says this like everyone knows it.
"Your mother and I are not getting a divorce." "Okay."
"Really, we're not."
"I heard you."
I take a long sip of my iced tea, and he does the same with his soda. He says nothing else, forcing me to begin. "How is everything?"
"Fine, Dad. How is everything with you?"
"It's great." "Anything new going on?" Rory hesitates. Our food arrives, giving him more time to think about what I am really asking. When the waitress leaves, he shakes his head a little,